You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. I am your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I am Brad Jackson.
We're recording this very, very tired today, so it may get a little squirrely.
Sorry, dude. It's 2:27 a.m. We're good.
Cigar nerds don't sleep.
Eastern time.
Sure. So what are we smoking this week, Brad?
We are smoking the Romeo Añejo. And I got to say, this is probably the first Romeo cigar I've had, and I am very, very happy with this cigar.
Yeah, I've had other Romeo and Julietta's, but this is the first of the Romeo series I've had, and it's the brand new at Añejo Zero.
Yep, Connecticut Broadleaf Vintage 2010 wrapper with a Dominican Oler Vintage 2008 binder, Nicaraguan and Honduran Vintage 2009 filler, and from the Dominican Republic. And, you know, we reviewed a lot of Nicaraguan cigars and stuff, but this is one of the few that we reviewed from the Dominican, and I gotta say, this thing is well balanced. I would put this at probably a medium to full body cigar.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably their most full bodied strong cigar that they produce. I mean, some of the other cigars are a little bit, you know, mild to medium. But yeah, this is definitely got a little bit more kick. It's got some Ligero in it, and the thing with this one too is like, so this is something brand new. It just came out. We picked it up at an event today. I got to talk to the rep for a little bit. And like I said, these cigars have, you know, like I said, they started production in like some of the tobacco inside of it is from like 2008. So this is, you know, a very, very aged cigar and double fermented, just like some beer. I thought that was kind of weird. I was like, I didn't know that terminology went with cigars, but learn new stuff every day.
Absolutely. That's why we do the podcast, not only to educate ourselves, but the folks listening. I got to say, man, this is an awesome smoke. I mean, it's so rich. It's, you know, coffee, chocolatey. I mean, it's right up my alley, being a stout drinker. I mean, dude, this is a perfect cigar for me.
Yeah, it has a blend of, like, you know, Honduran sun-grown tobaccos and, you know, Nicaraguan tobaccos that are aged in special cedar cajones, not to be confused with cajones, but which is basically a cedar cabinet, you know, fancy word for a cedar cabinet. But I got to say, yeah, it's a very, you know, full-bodied cigar, and it's got that kind of, like, coffee and chocolate undertones.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing about this isn't heavy on the pepper or the spices. I mean, this is, you know, being a full-bodied smoke, it's not what I would typically, I'm a little bit at a loss for words, but I mean, I'm enjoying this thing so much that I really don't want to put it down. But it's not over the top. It's not overpowering. Yeah, it's complex,
strong, but
it's smooth.
Without the kick of a strong cigar. You know, it doesn't have that like strong pepper taste. You know, it's a smooth strength, if that's, you know, even a correct description. But that's the way it sounds in my head, anyway.
Absolutely. The way it sounds in my head is delicious. I'm tired of talking about this thing. I want to go back to smoking more of it.
All right. Well, that will get back to the show. This week, we're talking about Mission Impossible. Your mission, if you choose to accept it, is listen to this podcast. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. This week, Your mission, if you choose to accept it, is listen to us talk about Mission Impossible for the next hour.
In its entirety?
Mostly.
Sweet.
Yeah, I mean, Mission Impossible started off as a TV series back in 1966.
Jesus, I didn't even realize that was that long ago. Yep. Like,
the original series ran from like 66 to 73 and then had like a new version in 88 that lasted for two seasons. It was about the IMF, which stands for Impossible Mission Force, which is kind of a weird name for a intelligence agency.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if it was designed that way by proxy. Like, what's the most unoriginal thing we can think of? Yeah, we're going to call this Mission Impossible, and we're the Impossible Mission Force. Like, okay, exactly. Cool.
Yeah, the
sounds like some shit I would have came up with.
The main star of Mission Impossible was Peter Graves, who played Jim Phelps, who he was not in the original cast. He started in season two, but he was pretty much the leader of the team from then until even the 88 reboot. He was the only original character kind of involved. And like I said, it was being in the 60s. It's all about, you know, Cold War, mainly Soviet bad guys and stuff. And it was... you know, if you go back and watch some of the old stuff, it's kind of funny how it's very formulaic. I mean, it pretty much always starts with him receiving some kind of recording of his mission, which always starts with that famous line, you know, your mission, if you choose to accept it, blah, 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 blah. And then ends with, this message will self-destruct in 5 minutes.
Seconds.
Yeah, seconds, whatever.
Seconds, minutes, who's counting?
Yeah, whatever. It was the 60s. Things went slower then. Minutes seemed like seconds. I mean, but yeah, but that's a cliche that has been parodied in so many other series. I mean, even Inspector Gadget, you always get that, you know, when Gadget gets his mission, you know, this message will self-destruct, and he always ends up, you know, blowing up his chief, trying to get rid of the message.
Damn it. Yeah, that was one thing that, you know, kind of throwed back is, you know, the different correlations there. There were so many similarities that I always thought was funny.
And, you know, I think as we talked about before, Leonard Nimoy was in the series, too, playing I can't remember his name. But basically he was a magician and actor that used his magic and acting skills to be a spy.
Speaking of Leonard, did you see the recent photos that were taken of him like last week where it looks like he's lost a lot of weight and stuff?
He's dead.
Oh, yeah. No. Oh, who am I thinking of?
I don't know.
I don't remember. Yeah, I remember our Nimoy tribute. My brain's not working.
The Magnificent Paris was his name. Yeah, Martin Landau was in this too as a Roland Hand. Pretty much, like I said, this was like the height of 60s spy genre shows. I mean, if not for this, you know, James Bond probably wouldn't have, you know, been as popular as it was when it came out, because, you know, James Bond came out around the same time. And like I said, any shows in the 60s are definitely spy related, but this one wasn't very, I mean, there was some action, but it was almost like, kind of like an Ocean's 11 of spy things. There was always some kind of just super elaborate plan to, you know, it was very, very mental and, you know, espionage, covert oriented with these wild schemes to get whatever intelligence or capture whoever or assassinate whatever.
This thing's very much reminded me of the Siphon Filter games being so stealthy and everything else that they brought to the table. So, I don't know. So, in your opinion, am I missing out by not seeing the TV series?
If you saw it in reruns in the early 80s, it would probably have been good. But going back and watching some of it now, it's severely dated. yeah, it's just, I don't know. I can't get around the how bad the 60s television series looks. But, I mean, the storyline, it still holds up. But, yeah, it's just... It's just
the way it's shot and everything else. Just what? Just,
yeah, it's not as visually appealing now.
Well, at your mature age and everything, I'll leave your opinion to that.
And well, you fast forward to 1996, we get the first Mission Impossible movie, if for those that did not know there was a TV series beforehand.
produced by Tom Cruise, might I add. And, you know, this one, this film here wasn't terrible. I mean, it was very much watchable. I mean, there were some things that didn't quite add up, and I'm like, from a producer standpoint, I'm like, maybe this isn't your forte, but I mean, at least it was a watchable film.
Yeah, the thing was, this was Tom Cruise's first production for his, like, production company. And, you know, he was a big fan of the TV series, and, you know, so this was really a passion project for him. But the thing was, his character that he plays in all the Mission Impossible movies is Ethan Hunt, which did not exist in the TV show. It was like, it's a completely original character for the movie. And they have the character of Jim Phelps, played by John Voight. And he is the big traitor. I mean, he turns out to be the bad guy. So people who were fans of the original series and the original actors was like, you know, this sucks because they've made our hero the freaking villain in this movie.
I think that's kind of a recurring theme, too. Like, it always seems like he's having to go rogue or he's always getting framed for something. Like,
yeah, I mean, pretty much the... But then again, it also, I mean, they came at it from this perspective that he spent his pretty much entire life working for this agency. He's getting to the point of retirement, and he really has nothing to show for it. So he's going to pull a heist, pretty much, and you try to sell some secrets and make his retirement fund. And you know, betrays his whole team and gets his entire team killed and blames, you know, frames Tom Cruise for it. So he has to go rogue because they all think he's the bad agent. As you'll see, this is a recurring theme in the Mission Impossible movies.
It's nice to know there's at least one constant.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, and also, like I said, this one had an updated version of that famous Mission Impossible theme, which was written by Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton of U2.
Yeah, with the electronic dance version. Yeah, I mean... And then later on, we had other bands do other renditions of this song.
And also, this was probably one of the first movies I saw of, you know, Bing Rames not as Marcellus Wallace. I think it was probably the first thing he did after Pulp Fiction. And yeah, he was the computer tech hacker guy, Luther Stickle.
Yeah, I mean, this is, what, the third highest grossing film of 1996?
Yeah, I mean... Despite all the, you know, people that didn't like it because of, you know, the lack of respect it showed for the original series. And, you know, some people, you know, who were used to maybe James Bond movies found this one a little slow. This one did try to kind of fit that original mold of more about the, you know, mind game of it all. So
yeah, I mean, it's weird that, you know, so much of this is based around the freaking Bible, verse of Job 3:14, like
that was, yeah, because that's supposedly the mole in their agency is he's the one that actually steals the data and is trying to, yeah, has framed him. And yeah, spoiler alert, later on we find out it's Jim Phelps has done all this to him. But yeah, it's a lot of just mind game stuff with just weird action sequences, like that scene of, I mean, Tom Cruise has to break into the database at Langley, the CIA headquarters, in this, like, room that any sound will set off an alarm, a change in body temperature will set off the alarm, you touch any surface, you'll set off an alarm. So he literally has to hang from a air vent over this and hack
and
this computer without
this
touching anything else
is,
in the room.
You know, freaking laser-controlled, too. I mean, like... It's just so over the top, but I guess if it wasn't that over the top, then it wouldn't be Mission Impossible.
Yeah, but yeah, you've seen that whole, like, him hanging from the ceiling gag referenced in so many other movies since then. I mean, I think even Family Guy has has referenced it. So, despite, you know, any negative comments about it, I mean, the movie was very successful. I mean, it was made for $80 million, and it made like $457 million. So yeah, it you know, blew up despite, you know, any fall, you know, downcomings of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? It was made on 80. Ah, dude, that's a freaking huge return. That's awesome. Especially for your first movie that you produced.
Yeah, I mean, it was directed by Brian De Palma, too, which, you know, is known for a lot of, you know, gangster action movies and stuff like that. So, he did get a good director to start off the series.
True that. yeah, this is, I mean, this is one of them that it still holds up today. Like, I can still watch this movie and enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw it, it was a little slow for me. I think the later films have been better. Just, the second one that came out in 2000.
Film almost ruined the series for me. Yeah, I quit following the series after this film, and finally I gave the third movie a chance, and I was like, okay, I kind of dig it, but,
Yeah, it's so weird because this one is directed by John Woo, who, you know, anyone who's a fan of badass kung fu action movies know who John Woo is. So it went from being this quiet,
like,
spy drama,
operative, yeah, you know,
to this weird, over the top action film with these bizarre action sequences,
crazy ass bicycle kicks, and
yeah, him doing all these kind of like flip kicks and weird capoeira moves, and just
something I would see in Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. And like I said, just completely different from the first movie. And this one, again, there is a traitor in the organization who has stolen a... we find out that this company has created basically this uber antiviral. But to create this cure, they had to create this super plague that would kill anybody within 36 hours. And so now the team has to go in and secure this drug that was stolen by a former IMF agent.
Yeah, I mean, it almost makes you wonder, you know, would your own government, you know, freaking release to the disease, forcing people to go out and just buy this vaccine as a...
I mean, that was pretty much the whole plan, was they were going to release this plague because they had the only cure, and then they could pretty much sell it for whatever they wanted to make, you know, billions and billions of dollars.
Although I do got to say, man, that, you know, the bioweapon being called Chimera, I thought that was a pretty cool name.
True. And like I said, since it is a John Woo movie, there's tons of slow motion pigeon and dove shots flying around during fight sequences that for no apparent reason. And like the weird motorcycle
chase.
For peace
and tranquility, man.
Where they're jumping off the motorcycles and like flying at each other, shooting guns. I mean, it is a straight up John Woo movie, so it makes no sense compared to the first one. And it really, like I said, after this one, I pretty much ignored the rest of the series for a while, because it was just like, you know, the movies just made no sense other than, well, you know, Bing Rhames back again as, you know, hit one of his partners, tech guy. And this one had
John Paulson as Billy, and let's see here. I don't know. I lost it. Brendan Gleeson as John McCloy.
Dougree Scott as Ambrose is the bad guy in this one. Anthony Hopkins as one of the head IMF agents. You know, this one still was very successful. I mean, made for $125 million, made, you know, $546
million.
So it definitely, someone liked it, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, like you said, John Woo is known for making great, awesome kung fu movies, and, you know, there's a big group of people that are big into kung fu movies. So, I mean, I can see where the success of this film came from. I mean, I don't know, it really... Knowing where the third, fourth, and fifth movies picked up and everything, like, this movie just wasn't my cup of tea.
Yeah, I love John Woo movies. And if this had been, like, the first movie where there wasn't another movie to compare it to, it could be a good movie. Like I said, the action sequences, even though they are ridiculous, are just completely, you know, badass and awesome. And I mean, it starts off with Tom Cruise, like, free climbing, you know, up this rock in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, they've kind of updated, you know, the, back in the TV series and even in the first movie when they get their missions with the famous, you know, your mission if you to accept it speech was like always like a tape recording. You know, this time they upgraded the technology. It was like a pair of sunglasses that he puts on and sees the whole mission thing, and then the sunglasses explode, and then you get like a freaking new badass theme song by Limp Bizkit. Which I had the soundtrack to this movie. That was a badass version of the Mission Impossible theme.
At the time, yes, it was. I mean, it wasn't bad. In fact, when I was just getting into guitar, I think this is like probably the only Limp Bizkit song I bothered trying to learn to play on guitar.
Yeah, I mean, it was a badass movie if you judged it solely on itself and did not try to compare it to any of the other films. But I think the problem that Tom Cruise ran into this is, I mean, if you look at his credits as a producer, he's done a lot of one-off movies. Yeah, there's not really been anything with a sequel or a series except for Mission Impossible. And it hasn't, like I said, Tom's not a director. He's not a filmmaker. Yeah. So I don't think he knew enough at the time about creating a world and having everything kind of fit in that world. So between the first one and the second one, it feels like two completely different movies.
They don't even feel like they're part of the same franchise.
No, there was no continuity with it. And when we get in the later films, they corrected that problem. But like I said, those first two were just so vastly opposed to one another that it kind of threw you off.
It definitely did.
Yeah. So, if you look at them, we're like the last three movies being their own separate trilogy and is kind of ignoring the first two. It's a real good series. Because like I said, those final three are set in even though they've got different directors, there's continuity to it. They feel like they're set in the same world. You know, they definitely built a world around, you know, Tom Cruise and you know, the IMF. But yeah, those first two, and the fact that, you know, the first movie, bad guy's an IMF agent. The second movie, the bad guy's an IMF agent.
I mean, yeah, you would think as the most, you know, I guess elite agency there is, you would do a better job of screening your folks. I mean, which then again, I guess there's a lot of, you know, if you're a freaking, you know, a terrorist organization or something, and you've got the money, the resources, and everything else, then ultimately, that's the person you're going to try to, you know, convert and, you know, basically oppose the IMF. So, I don't know. I guess at some point, you know, knowledge is dangerous when you know too much knowledge. But
that and being the super secret covert group that they are, there's, you know, not a whole lot of oversight. you don't have Congress breathing down your neck. There's not a lot of checks and balances when you don't really know the people you're working with other than those in your close, like, you know, cell, team, whatever. So yeah, I mean, I guess there is, yeah, too, what does it say, ultimate power corrupts ultimately, or however that old saying goes.
Yep, very true. So I don't know. This still just wasn't my favorite film. I don't know. Like you said, maybe if it was the first film in the series or something and there wasn't a comparison to draw it to, but I just really couldn't get behind this one.
Yeah, when I went back and, like I said, rewatched all of them this last week, like I said, judged on its own, it's a good movie. But yeah, just trying to, it just feels so out of place with the rest of the series that it just kind of threw me off. And I gave up on the series for a while. Like, I didn't realize until I went back to watch them all that I had never seen Mission Impossible 3 until, like, this week. Because after this movie came out, I was like, yeah, I don't care. But once I sat down and watched number 3, I was like, all right, now it's getting good.
Yep. So, with no further ado, I think we'll talk about the third film. I mean, this is directed by J.J. Abrams. And, you know, this is really, you start to see some continuity, some throwbacks to the original film. And all of a sudden, the storyline, it feels familiar.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely built a world and stayed in that world because, I mean, this was J.J. Abrams' first movie. So, I mean, we've seen all the things he's done since then. But, yeah, this being his very first movie, you know, and he also, you know, wrote and directed this movie. So, like I said, it definitely, if you, from here on out, like the next three, it definitely has a more continuity. I've probably said that a million times by now, but yeah, like I said, they all fit together. If you don't watch the first two, just watch the last three.
Yeah, absolutely.
You'll enjoy it far more. Watch the last three, then go back and watch the first two.
Yeah, don't try to follow them in chronological order. You'll disappoint yourself, potentially. I don't know.
Yeah, this one, again, Ethan Hunt is back, but he is retired from field work, and now he is the Obi-Wan Kenobi training the next generation of IMF agents, and you know he's met a girl and going to get married, but she doesn't know what he does. She thinks he works for like the DOT or or something boring like that.
DOT, IMF, I mean, basically the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Also had Maggie Q, which I think this is probably one of her first movies as well. As one of Ethan Hunt's team. Because basically, one of Ethan's trainees gets caught, so he goes out of retirement to try to rescue her. So they put together a team with him and Bing Rames is back, and he's not in the original part, but he shows up later on. But yeah, they're out to find some kind of weapons dealer that's out to get something they call like the rabbit's foot, which they never really explain what the rabbit's foot is. It's just some kind of doomsday weapon.
All you see is that little, you eventually see it with a biohazard symbol, but they never exactly tell you what it is. I mean, you assume it's some kind of biological chemical warfare weapon or something, but who the hell really knows?
Yeah.
But how innocent, the rabbit's foot. Like, yeah. Is this thing going to bring me good luck? Is it?
Good luck for somebody, not you. Yeah, and, of course, things go bad. His trainee gets killed on the mission. So now, Tom's back and out for revenge, trying to find Davrin, who's the bad guy played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And as a bad guy in this movie, he is freaking excellent. He makes the movie.
Yeah, I think he was probably one of the strongest characters. I mean, I don't know. Like you said, this is the film that really brought me back into the Mission Impossible scene, and I was like, after this one, watching the others was a breeze.
Yeah, when they first capture him, and it is so awesome because he's trying to interrogate him, and he just has this freaking monologue where Ethan's like asking him all these questions, trying to interrogate him, and he's just like, do you have somebody you love? Do you have a girlfriend? Do you have a family?
Yeah, I'm going to make her
bleed.
I'm
going to find them. I'm going to hurt them real bad. I'm going to make them bleed. And then they're going to be screaming your name, but you're not going to be able to do anything about it because you're going to be almost dead at the time, and then I'm going to kill them. And he's just completely, not even angry about it. He's just saying it matter of fact, this is going to happen to you. And it is the creepiest freaking speech. I mean, this guy, he's like, this dude is pure freaking evil without being over the top Joker-ish. I mean, he's just freaking quiet. You're this dude is.
I mean, he's a straight up sociopath.
Someone not to be fucked with.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Yeah, he's the guy that you don't want to be on the other side of the table from. I don't know. This film was to me was pretty awesome with the whole airplane scene and everything else. Yeah.
Also Lawrence Fishburne as the head of the IMF or one of the bosses. And also, like I said, Tom Cruise's wife doesn't know what he does, and of course, any movie where the bad guy is caught way too early in the film, he's going to escape and he's going to make you pay, just like he threatened you on the plane and told you all this. So he does find his girlfriend and makes him go steal the device for him, so he can,
do whatever evil thing. Try to rescue his wife and everything. Yep. Yeah, it was quite interesting. I mean, to see his character and the development and everything there with, there's just epic foreshadowing. I mean, because it plays out to a T exactly the way he describes it. So I thought that was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, and then the whole use there's a running gag in all of these freaking Mission Impossible movies that they almost completely run into the ground with this film, and then they never do it again. But it's funny because they joke about it in the other movies, but they never, this is the last time they do it, is these super realistic masks that they have of people.
Yeah, dude. I mean, that was like 3D printing foreshadowed before 3D printing became a thing.
Yeah, it starts off with like a head blank and then carves it to look exactly like the person and then, you know, paints it or whatever and makes these super realistic masks so they become the person they're trying to fool. And like I said, they use it in all three of the first movies, and then never again.
Yeah, this film was also weird that it took place in the Vatican.
Yeah.
I thought that was awesome.
That's the one thing about the Mission Impossible movies through the entire series, is the big set pieces where, I mean, they're literally filming on location all over the world. And just, I mean, one minute they're in Dubai, the next minute they're in friggin' Vatican City, and just, like, you know, is it really a global movie, you know, Shanghai, China? I mean, you don't, they're gonna be in like four or five countries through the series of like one movie.
Yes. I don't know, if you want to tour the world, join the IMF. I mean, that's, I guess that's how it goes.
The only downside of this movie is, yet again, there's a traitor in the IMF.
Damn it.
This is the third time there's been a mole inside the agency. This must be the easiest agency to get a job with, because there are apparently no background checks.
How do you do a background check on something that doesn't exist? Like,
yeah. And once again, Tom Cruise has to go rogue to save the day. I think he's gone rogue in like four out of the five movies. So it's like, you know he's going to get framed. You know he's going to go rogue to save the day. And there's probably going to be a traitor in the agency. That's a given when dealing with the Mission Impossible series.
I mean, that's okay, though. It keeps a consistency there. I mean, we were just talking about, you know, how the films, a lot of times, you know, especially with the second one, stuff didn't correlate at all. So, I mean, you got to keep the running gag going.
Then, like I said, the mistakes that I think they made with the first two, they've tried to correct with. So even though this movie had some of those elements that have played again and again in the first two, you don't see them again in the other three movies. They're like, all right, we've done that. We're not doing that anymore. Well, they still do some of it, but we're not doing most of it anymore. And also, this, you know, movie introduced Simon Pegg as Benny. In the first movie, he's just a, you know, IT guy within the agency. They're, you know, tech guru back at base, that building the little weird things that they're going to use and hacking into whatever.
Yeah, it's crazy, man, with all the super security and everything else, and they're able to manage, like, oh yeah, we got to go through like three combo locks, like all this other stuff, and they're able to break at stuff like it doesn't even exist.
Yeah, there's always going to be some like just weird acrobatic ninja thing that he has to break into in a movie that usually will involve something that you've seen earlier in the movie. Like I said, like the second one, you see him like, oh, he's climbing rocks at the first of the movie. Now he's going to have to climb up a building and do some other crazy stuff or dive through a sky lift that's only going to be open for a couple seconds, or, you know, swing and climb up the side of a building. So whatever skill you see him doing in his off time later, yeah, that's going to save the day at some point in the movie.
I mean, you always got to be prepared, right? Always operate on condition yellow. You never know. Yeah, this one here was interesting with all of the micro explosives embedded into people's heads and everything else. That was
yeah, that was the thing, that like the bad guy, not only is he evil, he freaking puts a bomb that's a tiny thing that shows up your nose. So even if you get away, he can blow your head off later.
Oh, damn it. So
yeah, and like I said, he's, when he gets, when, well, when he does have his wife and he's got him like tied up, facing his, you know, wife is, or you think his wife turns out to be another agent that he's used one of those masks on. Yeah, and he's like, I'm going to give you 10 to tell me where the rabbit's foot is, or I'm going to kill her. And he just keeps counting, and he's like, I already gave it to you. I got what you asked for. Is there something else? And he starts just trying to bargain with him. He's like, I can help you. I will go steal whatever you want me to steal. Just don't hurt her. And he just keeps counting. And he's like, and finally that time, he's like, I swear I'm going to fucking kill you. You see him like, you know, finally almost break. Yeah. I mean, up until this point, he has been like the unshakable badass, but this dude is so evil that, you know, he, he almost gets to him. I mean, he literally just completely breaks down in that scene, and that just makes him that much more of a awesome villain, that he is like the one guy that can hurt Tom Cruise.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that scene to me was, you know, very powerful. I mean, this is one as far as some of the acting and stuff like that goes. I mean, you couldn't think of a better villain. I don't think there's been a more memorable villain.
Not in this series, anyway.
So.
Yeah, he is the straight-up Darth Vader of the
mission. Yes.
I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman, great actor, and this is probably one of my favorite roles of his. And, yeah, it's just bizarre.
Yeah. All right. Do we dare venture into Ghost Protocol? So, yeah, this one here, this one was 2011. Once again, this is Brad Bird's first live-action film. And we get Ethan Hunt, Jeremy Rayner, Simon Pegg, and Paula Patton as his supporting team. And yeah. This is... Andre Nemec and Josh Applebaum?
I think so. I'm really not familiar with those actors. But the thing with this one, like I said, these final three movies kind of, like I said, all feel like they have some continuity. Because after Mission Impossible 3, J.J. Abrams stayed on as producer. So it was like, you know, a joint production with Tom Cruise's company and J.J.'s Bad Robot. So J.J. being a little bit more familiar with the filmmaking and directing aspect of it, you know, made sure these movies kind of coherently fit together. And they basically went from being these spy dramas to just straight up freaking action movies.
Yeah.
I mean, all these movies, they continue to have just these awesome, beautiful locations, but then bizarre, over the top, like truly what you would think is an impossible mission action sequences.
Yeah, and this is actually the first film to use IMAX cameras, too.
Oh.
So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, this is the one, because like I said, I had missed three. This is the one that brought me back into the series.
So yeah, this one here, they're in Budapest. Once again, we're going to travel all over the world, get to see the sights, and we're looking for the individual named Cobalt.
Yeah, I mean, it starts off with, you know, Benny the IT guy, Simon Pegg, has now been promoted to... you know, actual field agent. He's now kind of taken over Luther's role as the you know, in the field tech guy. And their first mission is to break Tom Cruise out of prison because some reason he's in this weird Russian prison that you really don't know why he's there to begin with.
Because it was intended to be. That's why.
And, you know, supposedly his wife has left him. And, you know, they bust him out of prison because they need him to bust into the
Kremlin.
Kremlin to get these plans because another agent has been killed who was getting some like Russian missile launch codes, and now they need to get a file on this Cobalt because they know he's going to delete the file. Well, it's all a trap. He blows up the Kremlin and blames it all on IMF. This time there's not a traitor in the agency, but the whole agency is framed instead of just Tom Cruise this time.
I mean, if you can't stop one guy, might as well try to take them all down. But yeah, this one here was probably, you know, outside of the third film, this one was awesome. I really liked the action sequences in this one. I liked you know, the storyline and, you know, just the whole entire, you know, aspect of this film. I thought was really, this one really put it in perspective in a modern term being made in 2011. So the action,
yeah, the effectiveness. I mean, when they blow up the Kremlin at the beginning, and then you finally meet you've heard about him. You finally meet the secretary of the IMF, and he's like, "The president is shutting us down. We are all to be, you know, we're basically all going to take the fall for this. But if you can escape in the next few minutes while we're on the way to the airport by assaulting me and my analyst here, who is Jeremy Renner." William Brandt, he's supposed to be just an analyst, which if you don't know anything about intelligence, you know, an analyst is basically a nerd. I mean, he's the guy that collates and analyzes all the data that the field agents acquire. I mean, these guys that are, you know, sit in offices with big books and and come up with these scenarios and try to figure out, you know, all these, you know, information stuff. So he's not supposed to be a field agent. He is introduced as, like I said, an analyst. But then, you know, the director's like, you know, your mission is, you know, to escape and prove that the IMF didn't do this. I happen to have forgot to tell the president about one, you know, weapons cache, then your support team will be waiting there for you.
Yes.
So basically now, like, the agency has to go rogue, not just Tom Cruise, to find this Cobalt who is, you know, he's got these launch codes. Now he's stolen a device to be able to launch nuclear missiles, and his play's a complete freaking anarchist. He wants to basically destroy the world bring down all governments, not just our government. So he's going to start World War III by, you know,
finding
launching
activation codes,
launching a Russian nuke. So we retaliate, and you know, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, I mean it's the ultimate setup.
And then, like I said, we get this, I mean, action sequence in Dubai where they're in like one of those giant 200-story high rises, and of course, Tom Cruise has to climb up the wall.
Yeah,
Spider-Man
style. Scale these windows, you know, and oh yeah, we made you these badass gloves that work by rolling your hand to suction to the glass. But you know what? This is breaking technology, so it's probably buggy.
Yeah, and Simon Pegg too. He's like, oh yeah, we can't hack into the system. You're going to have to break into the servers, which is like 10 floors up on like the 150th floor. And you know, there's no way in except for you to climb up the wall. And he's like, this is impossible. Like, yeah, but this, you know, impossible mission. This is what you're supposed to do. This shouldn't be a big deal to you. Because he's still kind of the...
This should be normal by
now.
Yeah,
he's still kind of like the rookie of the team. And, of course, when things goes bad, you know, Jeremy Renner's analyst turns out to be a complete badass. So they're like, they don't trust him now because they're like, there's no way you're a freaking desk jockey. You're a field agent. And you find out that... Because they said, you know, the reason why he's in prison is for an unsanctioned hit. Well, it turns out that supposedly his wife was murdered. And so he went rogue and killed the guys that supposedly killed his wife. And that's what wound him up in prison. And, you know, Jeremy Renner's character turned out to be the guy who was supposed to have been guarding his family. And, you know, so once he couldn't handle field work anymore after he's like, you know, he blamed himself for them getting killed. And so now he took a desk job because he didn't want to be responsible for anybody anymore. And then he's kind of like thrust back into field work. And I thought that was a cool, you know, flip on that character. Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely gave him a story arc. You know, he kind of gets his confidence back in the course of this movie and learns to be, you know, a badass once again, pre-Hawkeye.
Yes. That's where I was like, holy crap, that is Hawkeye.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like...
Yeah, without an arrow in his hand, you don't know who the hell he is.
But yeah, this was one of my... I think probably my second favorite of the series.
Yeah, I mean, it made $694 million. It was the highest grossing Mission Impossible movie and also the highest grossing Tom Cruise movie up until this point. We don't, you know, like I said, the new one just came out this week, so we don't know how well that one's going to do. But yeah, right now, you know, Ghost Protocol is the big bad on the block.
Absolutely. So, do we want to take it to the latest film?
Well, not quite yet. Yeah, toward the end of the movie, like I said, the guy actually does launch a nuke, and Tom Cruise and his, you know, manages to save the world at the last minute.
But not quite though, because the nuke still bounces off of a building.
Yeah, but it didn't blow up, so it's all good. You know, and yeah.
But the fact that a nuke bounced off of a building.
But yeah, up until this point, too, Tom doesn't know, you know, Jeremy Renner's secret. And he's like, you know, he's like, now that the everything's been rebuilt, you know, he's like, I need a new team. I'm back in the game. I want you guys to be my new team. And, of course, Ving Rhames shows up because he's not been in this movie until the very end. And he's like, yeah, my job is to dig that freaking nuke out of the bay that y'all dropped. So he shows up and has a beer with him and stuff. And Jeremy Renner's like, I don't know if you want me on your team. And he confesses, like, I'm the guy that was supposed to be guarding your wife when she was killed. And he's like, was she really killed? And he's like, what? And he's like, yeah, that's the reason why I was in that prison, is so I could get intel from this other dude. That was all an op. You know, she's fine.
Oh yeah, she's gone to live a life like you know. I mean,
the only way I can keep her safe is for everyone to think she's dead. And you know, he sees her like, you know, across the bank, kind of, you know, waves at her. You know, she, like I said, so she knows that he's, you know, they're not dead. You know, he just pretty much did her death to say, you know, protect her. So another guy doesn't kidnap her and uses her as a hostage. But yeah, he's like, no, we're cool, dude. You want to be part of my team? You know, you didn't fuck up. You know, that was an op, dude.
it was supposed to be that way.
Yeah.
Designed by proxy.
And that brings us to the one that just came out. Rogue Nation.
Yep. So spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, we're about to talk about it.
And they end it with, because the big bad guy in this movie is the Syndicate, and the at the end of Rogue Nation, you see Tom walking off into the you know, smoke and puts in his iPod, and there's like, your mission, if you choose to accept it, is to go after this, you know, organization called the Syndicate. So, you know, they, and sure enough, when the next movie starts, that's what they're in the middle of, trying to bring down the Syndicate that nobody believes exists.
Yes. Yeah, this one, I mean, this is straight up action flick from start to finish. Like, I really dug this film. I mean, you were familiar with a lot of the characters and everything else going on. There were some new faces introduced, but by and large, I mean, this is what I expected out of the Mission Impossible series. Like, there was no, you know, ifs, ands, or buts about this one. It was straight up balls to the wall for the most part. Like, some of the action sequences are over the top. Some of them are a little bit funny. So, you know, there was a balance of action and humor, and I had fun watching this film.
One last thing about the previous movie is Simon Pegg's character, like I said, they quit using the masks. It got old, and he's like, I want to wear a mask. And their mask machine breaks, so they end up just having to use like regular makeup effects. And so at that, he's like, when do I get to wear a mask? And it's like kind of like a running joke from then on. It's like, you never see those masks again. But he's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, I want to do a mission where I get to wear a mask. It, dude never gets to wear a mask.
So, all right. Well, jumping back. So filming began on Rogue Nation in August of 2014 in Austria, concluded in March of 2015, and just came out July 31st.
Yeah, and this movie starts off pretty much with, I don't know how in the timeline how close it is to the end of the first one, but it pretty much starts off with these congressional hearings of them trying to decide the fate of IMF, because the CIA is like, these guys are reckless. They almost got the world nuked.
Every time Ethan Hunt is somewhere, it blows up. It gets destroyed.
Yeah, like, and like I said, they've not even replaced the secretary yet. So it's Jeremy Renner as being the representative of the IMF, and Alec Baldwin is the head of the director of the CIA, trying to convince Congress to shut them down and, you know, move their assets into the CIA and put the CIA in control. And every time they ask Renner for a question, he's like, our policy is I cannot answer any questions without the, you know, express consent of the secretary. They're like, but there is no secretary anymore. That's y'all's problem. I'm still following the rules. But at the start of this movie, I had to agree with the CIA. Because, I mean, in just about every one of these movies, you know,
yeah,
someone has had to go
some
rogue.
Insurmountable evidence.
Yeah, just about in every one of these movies, an agent has been a traitor. Tom Cruise has gotten framed. They've had to go rogue to end up saving the world. So I get his point at the first of the movie.
Had a nuke bounce off a building and end up in the bay.
Yeah. So yeah, they don't have a great track record over the course of these movies. So I can understand. Yeah, and this Syndicate is so, they're like basically an evil version of the IMF. They're this super secret organization, almost like Spectre and James Bond, that no one believes exists except for Ethan Hunt and his team. And at this point, they don't believe him anymore. And yeah, they basically shut down the organization. So once again, Tom Cruise has to go rogue to stop these people and prove the worth of IMF, because he knows bad shit's about to happen if he doesn't take care of this stuff.
I mean,
and no one, there's literally no one else to do it at this point.
Everything that, you know, the IMF is planning, the Syndicate is one step ahead.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's a bait trap all the way through. Like, what do? You play right into the hand and hope for the best ultimately, but
Yeah, and at least this time it wasn't a rogue IMF agent. It was a rogue MI5 or MI6 agent. Basically an evil version of James Bond has created this organization and basically taken all these spies that are supposedly, terrorists, whatever, that are supposedly dead, and just, like, you know, gave them new identities, and they all work for this, like, super secret, you know, hit squad that is, you know, basically changing the world, and no one knows they exist except for Tom Cruise and his team.
Yeah. And I thought this film was interesting because of all their technology and everything else that they have to go on. Like, so much of this film's premise is, yeah, we got these two sketch drawings.
Yeah, because, like I said, since the agency has been shut down and he's having to work on his own, even when he gets Simon Pegg, who's sent back to being just a regular IT guy, when, you know, he kind of joins the group. These guys are people that are used to working with high technology, the support of all these, you know, agents and analysts and stuff. And now it's just him. I mean, he's him and his group of four. They're the entire agency. And so it's fun trying to see them have to adapt to that environment where they're no longer the big kids on the block. You know, they're having to, you know, go old school with it and you know, just kind of fight by their own skills because there's no one backing them up.
Absolutely.
There's no, like, you know, satellite spy network or nothing. It's like, it's them or nothing.
Yeah. Another thing that this film brought was I thought the whole opera layout was awesome. Like, you know, the freaking flute gun and, you know, some of that stuff that just looks like an average instrument, but nope, that's
the flute gun and the security guard that has the nightstick rifle that snaps together.
I thought both of those setups were freaking awesome.
Yeah, that and the, I can't remember her name right now, but the character that's, she's a supposed member of the syndicate, but, you know, spoiler alert, she's really a undercover British intelligence agent. So, and you really never know who she, if she's good or bad. I mean, one minute she's helping Lissa Tom Cruise.
Faust, I think, is what her name was.
The next minute she's screwing him over and tricking him into helping her and,
Yeah, that was such a weird, like, I never could quite pinpoint, like, is she good, is she evil? Because, like you said, you know, she would screw him over, and then she'd be like, oh, I'm here to help. Like, at one point, she actually ends up reviving him, only to, you know, basically manipulate him and stand in the middle of the road and force him to crash his motorcycle, and she just, I'm gone. Like,
steals the file they were supposed to get that they think is, you know, the evidence on the syndicate, but turns out it's, like, basically bank accounts. It's like, you know, this organization was set up by an element within British intelligence, and it was supposed to have been like a, just kind of like an exercise, a fictional thing that actually they made real. And this is like the money that would allow these people to, you know, basically, you know, take over the world.
Yeah, I mean, I forgot what it was. I forgot exactly how many millions of dollars in bank accounts.
Again, their plan to break in and steal this thing is like, Benny's like, I get to wear a mask this time. And I like it, like, when his, like, you know, his plan of how this is going to work, they've even updated the technology of the masks. Now, instead of it being this weird, like, carved out thing, it's legit 3D printed out of that, like, liquid 3D printing stuff. And they're like, nope, it's not going to work because they've got a whole new level of biometrics where it actually, like, judges how you walk and move and use that to identify you. So the only way in is to hack into this system. The only access is underwater and there's no metal detection, so you can't wear scuba gear. You got to hold your breath for 3 minutes.
Dude, and I got to say, that scene was a hell of a lot longer than 3 minutes. Like, my ass would have already drowned five times.
I couldn't hold my breath that long. No.
And, dude, that was just sheer luck, too. Like, the fact he goes and opens the server cap and he's got to replace the freaking profile card or whatever and ends up, like, dropping both of them, and it's literally just a 50-50 gamble.
Like, yeah, he's like, I hope this works.
Yeah.
Or Benny's dead. And then too, I like, too, because Tom Cruise, like, he drowns and gets brought back to life, but when he first wakes up, he's kind of disoriented, so he goes to do, like, the badass slide across the hood thing that he's probably done in every movie, and just wipes out and, like, busts his ass. Simon Pegg's like, dude, do you need me to drive? He's like, nah, I got this. Yeah, the car chases in this movie were just freaking excellent.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like the car chases. I thought it was funny, too, the fact that, you know, everybody's on high-end crotch rockets. And, you know, of course, you got BMWs all throughout the film. And, you know, who was it?
Ving Rhames and Jeremy Renner show up.
Yeah, show up in the freaking Land Rover like, dude, we need a sports car, and you pick the 4x4. Like,
they can't even turn around in the alley to... Yeah,
it turns into a 7-point turn.
Yeah.
So yeah. I thought that was freaking funny.
Yeah, it got pretty ridiculous. And then, you know, said they finally bring in the CIA director to, you know, basically convince him that, like, yeah, this thing is real, and they have to kidnap
darting the freaking prime minister.
Prime Minister of England, yeah, because he's the only one that can open the box. And, yeah, so they have to convince him that this thing is real. And, yeah, it's funny because they shoot him with the, like, tranquilizer/truth serum.
You know, they definitely didn't take any notes from the movie How High. I mean, dude, How High came out in, what, 90-something? Like, all you did is have the cannabis truth serum, and these guys are, like, having to dart people and go through all of this stuff. Like,
yeah. And he's like, yeah, ask him about this syndicate. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, ask him about him framing the agent. Yeah, that's also true. And he's so they're like, "All right, CIA director, here's the story. When the prime minister wakes up, this guy darted him, and you saved the day." And the prime minister is like, "Yes, yes, you saved the day. Thank you very much." Because he's still like high as a kite. <It's>,
So yeah, I mean, you know, the little comedy bits in there where. You know, a nice, you know, relief from just the straight action. But, you know, the action that was there, I got to say, was spot on. I mean, this was a very enjoyable film for me.
Yeah, I mean, great action, great suspense. I mean, even at this point where he's got to, say, turn over the file to the guy to save Benny, who gets captured. And it's all... a scam to trap this guy, and he's basically like, I've destroyed it, but I've memorized every file, so you can't kill me, because
he's like, I'll give you $50 million to let Benny go. It's like, here's, you know, shows a picture of the account number and stuff like that, and it's like, it's all in my head though.
Yeah, he's like, you know, if you want it, you're gonna have to come get me. And, you know,
I thought it was funny too, because you know, the foreshadowing when he goes in to what you think is just a record store, and he's talking to the lady about the classical music and stuff like that when he manages, you know.
Yeah, and she gives him a special record so he can check it out, which is going to be his, you know, IMF dossier and stuff. And she's like, you're really him, aren't you? And he's like, yeah. He's kind of looking at her, she's like, I've heard stories. I didn't think you existed. And he just kind of smiles and goes back there and starts listening to the record. And it's like, your mission would be to find the syndicate and do this stuff, but you're not going to do that. Because we are the syndicate, and you've just fallen into a trap, and we're going to kill you now, and like basically trapped in this, you know, record listening room where it's filling up with gas, and the main bad guy is just holding that one agent that was there to deliver his message, and just shoots him right in front of her, just to show him like there's nothing you can do. I'm like 5 steps ahead of you and stuff, and you know, like I said, he turns it on him and traps him in a box full of gas, just like, you know,
yes.
They're all centered around like, you know, this is the IMF, and you know, we've just. Shut you down.
Yes. Yeah, I thought that was an awesome ending to the film.
And then, of course, we get Alec Baldwin, you know, going back in front of Congress. Yeah, we need the IMF. And he's like, you were just here like last week telling us these people were, you know, 6 months ago telling us these people were evil. Yeah, that was an all in op. It was planned. I was cooperating with them. We had to do this to be able to prove the syndicate's real. And, you know, then they're like, Jeremy Renner's like, is this true? He's like, like I said, I can't answer any questions without the express consent of the secretary.
Yes.
So they're like, fine, Alec Baldwin, you're now the secretary. They reactivated, you're in charge, you have to deal with these assholes. They're like, yeah, welcome to the club, Mr. Secretary. He's like, oh, shit.
Yeah, I thought this was thoroughly a fun film. I enjoyed it. I don't know. I'm glad to see the way everything plays out. I'm curious to see what happens for Mission Impossible 6.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm back sold on the series. They can make some more of these movies. I'm on board. Like I said, since JJ has started, you know, co-producing these movies, they have gotten significantly better. Who directed this last one?
This was directed by Christopher McQuarrie.
Yeah, I'm not sure who. I don't know what else he is. he has done. I don't, but he, you know, he also wrote the screenplay and everything else. So as we kind of wrap this up, what do you think of this cigar as we're finishing up here?
I gotta say, man, I'm definitely sold on this cigar. I mean, I can't say anything negative about it. I mean, it remained consistent even through the second and final third. I mean, it didn't, you know, pick up in strength. It didn't minimize in strength. I mean, it was delicious all the way through. I mean, the coffee notes, the chocolate notes there. And I got to say, man, this is a damn smoky cigar, too. I mean, yeah. The smoke that rolls off this thing, I mean, it just, within two or three puffs, I mean, it's a nice cloud of white smoke and everything. I can't say enough about it. I mean...
Yeah, I'm sold. I've never tried. I've tried some Romeo and Juliet's, but I've never tried any of the Romeo series because they, like I said, most of their cigars are a little bit, you know, milder than what I normally smoke. But yeah, this has definitely got some strength to it. I may have to try some more of their stuff because I'm really enjoying this cigar.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to you know, pair this with a Scotch or something like that. Maybe that's on tomorrow's agenda because I got another one sitting in the humidor. Yeah, that's right. I didn't just buy one of these. I got two. Like,
yeah, I'm already smoking my second one. I smoked the other one earlier. So, yeah, I'm definitely sold on picking up some more of these. Well, with that, we will disavow any knowledge of our existence and be back with Beer 30.
Stay tuned.
In spite of this trap, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to get the document and bring Anna Kirkoska to safety. As always, should you or any member of your IM force be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Good luck, Jim.
Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And we're back with Beer 30. What are we drinking this week, Brad?
We are drinking Southern Tears Chocolate Orange. And I gotta say, dude, I was pleasantly surprised. Like, I saw a sign saying, hey, we got Southern Tier Chocolate Orange. And I was like, orange with chocolate? I don't know.
I mean, I've had those, like, you know, freaking the chocolate orange candies that, you know, look like an orange, and it's kind of just like it's, you know, made of chocolate, but has that orange flavor to it. And, you know, it's usually not a bad combination, but, yeah, this is definitely a, what I would consider a dessert beer.
Oh, yeah, by all means. I mean, I was reading some of the stuff, and a scoop of some vanilla ice cream or something like that with this poured over it would probably be amazing. But yeah, I mean, this is it's a pretty big beer. I mean, this is a 10% ABV, you know, heavy body. It's saying it's got a moderate bitterness, but to me, it's just a hint. And maybe it's because the beer may be a little bit colder than it should be. They recommend serving this at 48 degrees. But, you know, as it comes up to temperature, I'll let you know if there's any bitterness or anything that comes out of this. But
it is an imperial stout brewed with chocolate and orange peels. This is pretty much new. I think this is like the first year they've introduced it. It's part of their, like, Blackwater series that's, I mean, they've done the regular chocolate, cream brulee.
Yeah, people remember that one. I think that one was released, like, in 2007. And I was a big fan of chocolate.
I mean, even that freaking horrible Warlock pumpkin ale that we had, it was part of the series. But this is definitely a lot better than that freaking pumpkin Warlock we tried.
Well, I mean, that was just overpowering of the pumpkin. Like, I don't mind, you know, the fall months when pumpkin flavored everything shows, but that one was a little bit tough for me to get through.
This one reminds me, if you've ever had the old orange dreamsicle ice cream bars, that it's what it kind of tastes like, that orange orange creamsicle. With just a little bit of like a hint of chocolate on it. Like, you dip one in like some freaking chocolate sauce is about how this the best way to describe this flavor.
I don't know. I mean, I definitely get a lot more of the chocolate notes, but I mean, as a, I guess, like you said, a dessert beer. I mean, I'm actually pretty stoked and really happy about this one. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just the alcohol content that makes me satisfied. I mean, you do get a little bit of that alcohol taste, but it's not overpowering at 10% like some of the higher gravity beers.
Yeah, it's definitely got a very creamy taste to it. And it's, like I said, their food recommendations is like shortbread cookies, bread pudding, or like we said, in a, you know, ice cream float. I'm very happy with this beer.
And it doesn't seem to be overly carbonated or anything either. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's very drinkable.
I don't know, man. I was a little bit concerned about the beer because I was like, I don't know about it. But I'm a big fan now. I'm sold.
Yep.
And the price point was right, too. I mean, I think for the Bomber, it was like $7 or something like that. So it was on the, you know, cheaper end of the scale.
Yeah, and for your you homebrewers, they actually list like the ingredients on the bottle, like all the hops and malts and stuff that they've used. So, you know, if you want to play around and try to brew one of these yourself, you can, you know, kind of guesstimate the recipe from the ingredients listed on the bottle.
I know a couple of guys that are homebrewing.
Well, until that first beer comes out and it actually tastes like beer, I don't know if we're homebrewers yet or not.
I mean, we got some oak-aged bourbon chips soaked in our secondary fermentation. So, I mean, I think we're there, man. I think we're there. But
we got about another 2 weeks before we can sample that and let y'all know if we failed or not.
what are you thinking as far as your rating on this beer?
Oh, this is at least a like 4.5 for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm at a probably 4.75. I love the sweetness of the chocolate on the front end. I mean, like I said, being a huge fan of the chocolate beer itself.
Yeah, I don't know about drinking this, like, you know, just sitting down somewhere having a beer. I don't know if I would order this, but, you know, if I was having a meal, you know, something like this would definitely be a good, like, after-dinner dessert, dessert beer.
I would be curious to pair this with, you know, more of a kind of a milder cigar or something.
I do want to try the ice cream float, though, now that I've seen that recommendation.
Yeah, that'll have to be next on the agenda. So, yeah. Any final thoughts or anything outside of damn good beer? Awesome selection. Way to go, Brad.
Drink more beer.
Word. All right, stay tuned for the next segment, folks.
And we're back. It's time for some science.
Yeah, yeah.
You ready to get your doctorate in useless information?
Oh, let's go for it, man. What do you got for us?
All right. First up, the Snotbot.
Is this like a remote-controlled Kleenex or something? I mean...
Which would be a pretty good idea. I mean, it does sound like some kind of weird movie villain, the Snotbot.
I mean, nothing's worse than being sick, laying in bed, having to get up and run to grab a tissue because you're... nose is dripping a gallon of mucus a second.
Yeah. Well, anybody who's a fan of building drones, flying drones, or which I really want one, now scientists are using it to study whales.
Sweet.
Ian Kerr, of the CEO of Ocean Alliance, has developed this thing that they're with the Owen College of Engineering. It's basically like one of your drones that you buy anywhere else, but it's hooked up with special scientific equipment that they can now fly over whales and suck up particulates from when they, you know, basically blow their blowhole, as you see in so many videos, and collect all kind of data from their snot.
So that's very interesting. So, I mean... I don't know, man. I see so many times people go on these whale sighting expeditions and everything else and don't see stuff at all. Like, I wonder how much time you spend before you actually run across a family of whales. Or well, I think a family of whales is considered a pod, right?
Maybe.
I don't know. Could be something else.
The Pod Podcast? It's a podcast all about whales?
Could be.
Yeah, I mean... One of the benefits of using this is, well, I mean, you can find a whale with, like, sonar or whatever, because they're pretty freaking big. But trying to get close enough to study them up close is very hard to do, because they're going to, you know, swim away from you. And this is the least invasive way to collect data on the whales. And it's also, since you're not having to equip a big expedition, basically you can go out there in like an inflatable boat with just your, you know, remote control and your drone, and it's going to be able to get closer to the whales without actually having to get closer to the whales.
Yeah, and it's awesome too, because they're actually collecting DNA, viruses, bacteria, stress hormones, pregnancy hormones, all kinds of stuff. Like,
It's very hard to do a pregnancy test on a whale. It's going to be real hard to get them to pee on a stick. But with a snotbot, you can collect all that data, without even getting anywhere near them.
Interesting.
And freaking them out. Plus, it's cool because you can say you're a snotbot pilot.
And you get to play with drones and all kinds of high-tech computer electronics, which I'm down for.
Yeah, we need to get some drones.
That's the last thing we need.
I mean, I've been wanting an excuse to buy a GoPro so we can record the podcast. I mean, buy the GoPro, you have to get a freaking drone for it. I mean, it's just standard. I mean,
but the problem is you're going to have a drone down here, and people are going to be like, what the hell is that pissed off bumblebee noise? And
it's a silent one. We do like outside. We get it flying high. It's all good.
Nobody wants to watch this podcast in a smoky basement. Like, holy crap. Is it possible for two people to generate that much smoke in that enclosed of an area?
Yes,
how are they not dying?
Oh, how is the dog not coughing? But other than the snotbot, remember the movie Hackers?
Absolutely, dude. I love how great that movie is.
Oh, yeah. We need to just do a friggin' whole podcast on Hackers. But a couple hackers that are doing something, good for the world has figured out you can hack into cars that are equipped with Wi-Fi. So now is all these new cars coming out that's got, Wi-Fi and internet technology built into the cars. They've actually, found some vulnerabilities to hackers. Two guys, Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek, however you pronounce his name. They were able to hack into the new Jeep Grand Cherokee Uconnect infotainment system and take control of the car. I mean, they were able to, turn on the windshield wipers, mess with the steering, shut off the brakes, script the stuff on the dashboard, cut off the transmission. I mean, basically take, full control of this car, which would be a very bad thing if you're doing, 75, 80 on 285 and all of a sudden, your steering locks up and you go into a guardrail.
Yeah, that's no bueno. I mean, you hear about, all these hacks, especially this big one that just took place with the federal government and everything. I forgot what, something like 20 million people were impacted. I think originally reported it was like 1 or 2 million. And, we hear about all these places that you think should be the most secure, and they're getting hacked every day. And here we are, we got automakers just like, oh, yeah, let's throw all this connectivity shit inside cars. And, I'd say you got to have like some strong, security protocols, because that could be very dangerous.
Yeah, to prove their point, these hackers actually got a rider to drive a car and demonstrate as they hacked into it. They told me, no matter what happens, don't freak out. We are in control. Don't just like panic. And basically as he was driving around, they freaking started messing with the air conditioning, the radio, the windshield wipers. And eventually he even got on like an overpass where there's nowhere to get off the road, and they put the transmission in neutral. So, the guy couldn't even, move the car or get off the road, and just kind of slowed to a stop in the middle of the highway, which, if you were, say, trying to kidnap somebody and you had a hacker that could take over somebody's car and just basically shut it down somewhere where there's no escape, or hell, even take over it completely and drive it to wherever you wanted to take them over. I mean, that's some bad stuff.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I just see spybot or not spybot. Holy crap, I'm talking spyware and everything else. Skynet, taking over, and all of a sudden, self-aware your cars are crashing into one another or going back to central command or something like that, and you have no control. Like, what do you do? Yeah. You just dive out of a moving vehicle? Or
I mean, I would I probably wouldn't do anything like evil if I had that technology, but I would definitely screw with people, turn the heat up to max during the summer, or put their radio station on the worst freaking radio station I could find. Make them play Cigar Nerds podcast over and over again.
nonstop, repeat.
But like I said, these guys are actually doing this for good, and they have turned over all their data to Chrysler, who has said they have patched the problem and even issued some recalls on some of the vehicles to fix this vulnerability.
Speaking of Chrysler, did you hear about them potentially how many hundreds of millions of dollars where they're going to have to rebuy back old Jeeps and certain Ram trucks and everything because they never fix the recalls and everything properly, so the vehicles are unsafe to operate? Like, I forgot there's been 70 or 80 deaths linked to this, and coming from the same company, we've patched this.
Yeah, so like, yeah, that may not be actually true. So yeah, if you're paranoid like me, you may not want a car with Wi-Fi.
I mean, I think that's another reason I love, you know, old school muscle cars and everything else. Not only for the showcase and the badassdom and, you know, the beefy horsepower and everything, but less computer electronics. Like, I can actually go out there and work on the thing using modern wrenches. Yeah. And
when the
stuff.
Apocalypse happens, you know, the 60s and 70s cars, we can still fix those. There's not computers in them, so we don't have to worry about, you know, freaking, you know, EMPs or whatever shutting stuff down. We can, you know, break out the old 70s Dodge wagon or something and, you know, go all Mad Max.
That's what I'm talking about.
Speaking of Mad Max and weird alternate history, the Kepler telescope has discovered a new Earth-like planet.
Yep, Kepler 452b.
Yeah. Basically, like I said, NASA's Kepler mission has been sent out to discover as many alien worlds that, we're not speaking like, you know, aliens, but, you know, worlds not of our you know, immediate solar system. And they've already discovered like around 1,000, you know, new planets, but they've started, you know, documenting some that are in what we are in now. They kind of refer to as the Goldilocks zone. It's not too hot, not too cold. We're in that perfect distance from our sun to support
habitable life forms.
Not just habitable life, but our style of habitable life forms. I mean, because they, you know, could be some kind of weird life form that we don't know about that have evolved on some other type of planet. But to have life forms that are more likely similar to us, this is, they need planets that are in like the Goldilocks system. And this Kepler 452 is 60% larger than Earth, and their sun is like about 10% larger than our sun. But it's like, you know, around 1400 light years away, but and it's a little bit older than our Earth as well. So they said, you know, if life were to evolve, this would probably be the best case scenario for, you know, Earth-like life, you know, forms to evolve. Since it looks like all the, you know, we wouldn't know unless we actually got there, but from, you know, what we can see from the, you know, telescopes and stuff, it looks like all the elements that, you know, we have on Earth would be also present there. So, you know, if there is life outside our universe, this is probably the best chance scenario to find something similar to us.
I think it's naive, and we've discussed this many times, but I think it's naive to think that we are the only life forms, you know, out there. I mean, think of all the billions of unexplored, you know, places that we haven't even been to. We've only explored a handful, and we're finding stuff almost on a weekly, daily, you know, basis
that we've, you know, yet to discover. But yeah, I mean, and even if say there's a life form on some of these other planets, I mean, if they're say similarly technological to us, yeah, you know, they may not be like what we consider aliens. You know, they could still be like, you know, basically just, you know, exploring our close neighborhoods like we are. So yeah, it may be another couple thousand years before we could actually make contact with any kind of civilization. You know, because if they're the same technological evolution that we are, then, you know, they can't travel 1400 light years.
Let's just hope we haven't sent out a time capsule and, you know, we start having real life pixels.
I can't wait to see that movie. I think that's like the closest we're going to get to Ready Player One. That's like the first step to getting a Ready Player One movie.
I don't know. I'm interested to see pixels, but it's getting a lot of hate. But another topic for another segment.
Yeah, because we haven't seen it yet. The other thing that I saw, I found kind of disgustingly interesting this week, was surgeons attached a hand to a dude's leg. So now he can give himself low fives.
Yeah. Dude, this picture's creepy.
Yeah, that's what why I had to, when I saw this come across my news feed, like, I was
this
like...
This is an article we definitely need, like, I was like video I've, or something.
Yeah, I've got to look at that. Basically, a Chinese worker in a factory got his hand cut off, but his arm was so mangled that they could not reattach the hand to his arm, so they had to keep the hand alive until the arm healed enough for them to reattach the hand. So they basically attached it to, you know, blood vessels and stuff in his legs. And
I mean,
it kept
looks like
the
it's
hand
just
alive.
Like right there below his calf.
Yeah.
Like,
and it kept the hand alive for like a month until they could finally, he was healed up enough to reattach it to his arm. Yeah. Just the picture of a hand coming out of somebody's calf just looks like some weird horror movie experiment gone wrong.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Like, I mean, I understand boot cut jeans, but like hand cut jeans, I don't know. I don't even think I should be picking fun at this. I feel like an asshole now.
Low five, man, low five. Yeah, this happened at the Chinese Zhengyu Hospital. And, you know, apparently the very first reattachment surgery occurred in Japan in 1965. They reattached a finger, and like since then, pretty much, you know, as long as the... Yeah, organs aren't too damaged. It's, yes, quite common if you can get to a hospital soon enough and preserve it that, you know, we can pretty much reattach anything. I mean, hell, dude had his penis reattached. So pretty much, you know, anything could be reattached at this point.
I was not ready for that.
Yeah, I mean, they've pretty much perfected the reattach. But yeah, this whole grafting a hand onto your leg to keep it alive is just, that's kind of creepily interesting.
That's spooky.
At least it's not like human centipede. I mean...
Next.
Oh, I saw one other thing that kind of came across my news feed. NASA is, I may have even talked about it before, but NASA is kind of experimenting with warp drive technology, just like Star Trek. And one of the scientists working on this program that we are, like I said, they're kind of working on creating small examples of a warp bubble in the lab. But one of the scientists on this project released his 3D rendering of what the eventual NASA warp ship would be, it would look once they built this thing.
So once this thing is a success and dialed in, does everybody then do the time warp? It's just a jump to the left.
Yeah, this ship looks pretty bad at it. It's like got these two big rings around it. With like, you know, traditional looks like kind of rockets in the middle, but what they're saying with this warp bubble is it will actually kind of, instead of violating, you know, Einstein's laws of faster than light travel, this one actually kind of shrinks the distance between two points with this warp bubble technology. So they said with this we can get all the way to, if once it's fully functional, like all the way to Alpha Centauri, wherever that's at, but it's a long way away, and that's kind of like always the I guess the most habitable planet that they've think we could get to within like 2 weeks, which right now it's like, you know, freaking, you know, several hundred years away. But we could make this trip in 2 weeks if this warp technology eventually gets, you know, able to be developed and used.
That's pretty freaking awesome. End of life event? No, we're just going to warp somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean...
Call up Chris Pine, man. Yeah, fire up the Enterprise. We're out of here. All right, I think about wraps us up for science. Stay tuned.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Cornflake.
So we host the Flopcast.
We cover nerd and geek subjects of all types, but this is sort of a sillier, goofier side of geekdom, I'd say.
We love to talk about music, especially funny music.
We talk about comic books, conventions.
Saturday morning cartoons.
Oh, yeah. I'd say if you're going to put the Flopcast in Brady Bunch terms, we're like the Cousin Oliver of podcasting. And we do a ridiculous new Flopcast episode every week.
What is wrong with us?
We really have nothing else to do. We're part of the Earth Station One Podcast Network.
And you can find us at flopcast.net.
And now it's time for All Things Nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News, folks. Yeah, no dozing off, dude. I mean, come on. It is almost 3 o'clock in the morning, but...
All right, what's going on in the nerd news this week, Brad?
Well, as if we haven't talked enough about it, Deadpool. Looks like we're going to get a Red Band Deadpool trailer, and that is set to debut on Conan on August 4th.
Which should be the day this podcast release.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so for y'all that were lucky enough to see the leaked Comic-Con trailer before it got taken down pretty much everywhere with that bad, you know, handheld cell phone camera version of it, you know, we'll actually finally see the official trailer, so... I am excited.
Yeah, I'm curious to see it with all the finalized special effects and everything else that wasn't necessarily in the Comic-Con, or, yeah, San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah. I mean, a Red Brand trailer, too. There should be some, like, you know, good violence and other bad things.
Yeah, well, I mean, we already know that this movie is going to be hard R, so I'm super stoked about it, super excited, so I'm going to watch this trailer, and, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'll have to stay up and watch some Conan Tuesday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love his Cuban episode, too. Like, it's crazy, because I very rarely watch Conan, and the few episodes that I catch, I'm like, why don't I watch more of this? But
yeah, especially that episode where he went to Cuba, and he got to, you know, central to our interest, you know, he went to a cigar factory and got to try rolling cigars, and he was not very good at it, but it was kind of amusing seeing how the... how they're made in a, you know, traditional factory.
Absolutely. I like to mess in with the locals, too, where he goes and does the rum tasting, tries to walk off with the bottles and stuff. Obviously staged, but awesome. Up next, a little bit of Walking Dead news. So it has been confirmed that Fear the Walking Dead won't be a crossover with the original series. And I got to say, I'm grateful for that. I think a meshing of the two stories and everything else since, you know...
Well, from what I've seen of the new trailer and stuff, it seems to take place at a different timeline. It takes place earlier. It takes place at the...
This is going to be a prequel showing the onset of the apocalypse. Of the outbreak, yes.
So, yeah, it would be hard to do a crossover since these things are taking place at two different timelines unless they, you know, jump... head into the story.
Well, I mean, you know that.
Plus, it's like a long way away. Yeah, those guys haven't got out of Georgia. Now I think they're up somewhere up north. But yeah, they're still nowhere near the LA or wherever the new series is take place at.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other part too is The Walking Dead being so heavily based on the comic books and stuff like that. Like, I'm just glad that they're going to keep their own separate shows and identities.
I just want to, since this was taking place in LA, I want to see like celebrity zombies. I want to see, like, you know, a zombie Chris Hardwick running around or something.
Zombie Bill Murray. Just yeah. Shotgun blasted. Damn it. It's, what was that? What was that film? Oh, shit.
It's Zombieland.
Zombieland, yeah. For some reason, I wanted to say The Day of the Dead or something. I'm like, oh, that's not it at all.
The Day of the Dead is when they're on the roof of the mall and they're sniping zombies that look like celebrities.
So even being 3 a.m., I'm still sort of on premise. That's good. You know. All right. So I'm almost sick of reboots, okay? You know, we've bitched and complained about it so much, but what I'm kind of excited about is apparently Married with Children is going to get a reunion that's supposedly in the works. So that would be interesting. A little throwback to 1997.
Yeah, I'm hearing this time around it's going to be... Bud's family. He's going to be the owl this time.
Wow, dude, that was pretty hardcore. Like,
yeah, I need a drink. My voice just like went completely out on me.
That's what happens at 3 a.m., folks. You start with a voice, all of a sudden you've got no voice.
That was my third cigar tonight. So yeah, I may be a little burnt out.
Absolutely not. So I don't know, you know, Christina Applegate's coming out and saying she's excited about it and stuff. So, hey, we'll see what the future beholds.
We'll see Grandpa Al and Peggy. You know, I always wanted them to do a reunion while she was on Sons of Anarchy. I thought that would be awesome. Have Al show up as like an FBI agent or something.
Yeah,
you know,
just make some kind of an appearance somewhere.
Just like something completely random that they all all end up together.
Little more Netflix news. Jessica Jones has confirmed and will debut in 2015, probably November, December. We don't have.
They
a
said
hard
it was going to be
yet.
In the fourth quarter of the year, and now they're saying that they're going to be releasing a new Marvel series every 6 months. So we're going to get a little bit, you know, more regular with these Marvel releases. And I'm looking forward. I mean, Daredevil was awesome, so I'm waiting to see what they do with the rest of the series.
Yeah, I really like Daredevil. I'm curious to see about Punisher, though, because I did read some news that they're not going to make that a rated R series, so I'm like...
And then again, I mean, it's Netflix, and I mean, Daredevil was pretty freaking violent. If that's not considered R, then I guess you can't be R just on based on violence. You got to have, I guess, some like foul language and some nudity to make an R these days. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, now that we got hard R's and all kinds of sub-ratings, I don't even know where to begin anymore.
Yeah, I assume it's still going to be bloody violent. I mean, it's the Punisher. How else can you do the Punisher without some, like, you know, good old-fashioned mayhem?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. You know, we had the passing of Roddy Piper.
Oh, yeah. Anybody who's like a classic wrestling fan, the dude has been around here forever. And he's, I mean, not only as a wrestler, but as an actor, too. He's been in several movies, and probably one of his most well-known roles, if you're into classic sci-fi, is 1988, They Live. I mean, anyone who's ever heard the term, like, I'm here to kick ass and chew bubblegum, and I'm all out of bubblegum, that started in that movie. You know, everyone else has referenced it, you know, and no telling how many different movies and video games since then. He's the man that started that line.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, going back, I mean, he was in WrestleMania 1 back in 1985, squaring off. You know, he squared off against Hulk Hogan, which has now been banished from the WWE and everything, as well as Mr. T. So, I don't know, man. I'm a little bit conflicted on the whole Hulk Hogan thing. I don't know enough background, but, I mean, I feel like in a lot of ways that he's such an iconic icon that, I mean, we all make blunders and mistakes, but...
An iconic icon.
Yeah. Dude, I'm allowed to say stuff like that, okay? I mean...
All right, whatever. We'll fly with that.
How many beers have we drank today? And plus, we brewed beer. I mean, it's been a pretty productive day. Hence, we put off recording, so now it is 3:15 in the morning. Awesome. The Netflix series... Wet Hot American Summer. I have not had an opportunity to check that out, but it is on my recommended list, and I feel like I'm probably going to do some binge watching tomorrow.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about the movie during our summer movie episode. But yeah, on July 31st, they released a series, which is technically a prequel to the movie, if you've seen the movie, which is supposed to be the last day of summer camp. This one is the first day of summer camp, and it's an 8-episode series, but it all takes place in one day, just like the movie did. And I gotta say, it's pretty hilarious seeing, because I'm about halfway through the series yet, and you see them referencing so many things that appear in the movie, that kind of like setting up the stuff that the jokes you've already seen. You see like the setup of them now. And
yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I'd like to, you know, see is the origins of, you know, the guy, you know, the crazy ex-Vietnam veteran and stuff like that. Like, you know, the yes. origin of the can of tomato yeah. soup and how he ended up so batshit crazy.
Yeah, because he starts off the series as, like, completely preppy dude and this, like, just falls apart through the course of the series. I mean, I love it. It's pretty hilarious. It was funny since it's technically supposed to be happening a prequel, but it takes place, it filmed 15 years after the original. Most of the cast still looks the same. There's a few of them that have not aged well, and it's kind of funny that this is supposed to have happened beforehand, but they look really old now.
Yeah, that's the thing that's kind of concerning me a little bit. But you know what? I'm going to go into it with an open mind, and I'm sure I'm going to love the series just as much as I did the film.
And speaking of Paul Rudd and Wet Hot American Summer, that's another thing that happened since the last time we recorded. Ant-Man came out.
Absolutely. I have not had an opportunity to see it, so try not to give too many spoilers away, keeping me in mind, but give us your thoughts.
Well, Iron Man, Captain America, everybody showed up. They had tea with Ultron. No, just kidding. No, that stuff happened. But I got to say, I really enjoyed it because... We're so deep into the Marvel series of movies, it's hard for them to do anything new and innovative. And I don't know if the technology has caught up or something, but this one was actually something new. It was like a new idea. Just the way they filmed it with going from full-size perspective down to the, you know, microscopic perspective and, you know, back and forth. And also that this movie is probably the one I would say has the most heart of all the Marvel films. I mean, this one could be considered almost a family film. I mean, there's a lot of comedy that you don't necessarily get in, you know, Avengers and stuff. I mean, there's funny stuff in Avengers, but you know, there's still a lot more like serious stuff. And this one definitely has that with, especially with Paul Rudd being in it. There's a lot more of a comedic element, but still ties into the larger Marvel universe. You know, there's the references and the cameos and whatnot. And there's even like, we don't get to see Spider-Man yet, but we know he's going to show up in Civil War. They've announced that his scenes in Civil War has been filmed. It's confirmed he's in it.
Who's that guy playing Spider-Man again?
Tom Holland, whoever. I still say I think it's the guy from Blink-182. That's really all I know him about. But yeah, there are some references to Spider-Man in this movie, even though you don't get to see him. So they're kind of teasing, you know, that's coming. And like I said, you get to see at least one Avenger show up in this that I thought was a really cool interaction. I mean, well, you've seen that in the trailer, you know, Falcon's in it. You know that much from watching the trailer. But I really liked, you know, the interaction with him and Ant-Man. That was pretty cool. But yeah, it was just, like I said, the comedy and the fact that they actually was able to innovate in this movie and show me something that I haven't seen four or five movies already. So I'm looking forward to him being in the Marvel Universe.
Watching the trailers, I kind of got the impression that Ant-Man was going to be like a microscopic Tony Stark in a sense, just the way that, you know, some of the action, I guess, the way the suit looked and stuff like that, it seemed like it had a lot of similarities to Iron Man, but maybe that's not the case at all. I don't know. Well, I'm going to have to go see it.
Because, his character in the movie is not the original Ant-Man. The original Ant-Man is Hank Pym, and as you've seen, Michael Douglas in the movie, he is the original Ant-Man, but he was a hero in the 60s up till, like, you know, maybe the 80s, and has since retired, and stuff has come up where he needs someone to take over the Ant-Man identity and help him out, so he recruits this good-hearted cat burglar to take up the mantle of Ant-Man and train him to be the next generation's Ant-Man. So, yeah, he's kind of like the Bruce Wayne training the new Batman. If you've ever seen Batman Beyond, it's kind of the feel of it.
cool. So we're gonna move into a completely different opposite spectrum, just because we know Sharknado 4 is now confirmed.
Yeah, that's another. Another few things happened since the last time we recorded. We got a few new bad sci-fi monster movies. Sharknado 4, of course, which, if you've seen any of the other Sharknados, Sharknado 3, just came out.
Yes.
And it is bizarre. I mean, we have David Hasselhoff astronaut in it.
I mean, as soon as I found out David Hasselhoff was in the film, I was like, what, we're going to get a slow motion, like, beach running cameo, a throwback to the old school Baywatch days? But apparently that's not the case at all.
Oh, no, he's the father of the main character in all the Sharknado movies, and he's also a astronaut, because this time sharks are in space for some reason.
That'll be okay. We can get David Hasselhoff slow bouncing on the moon.
Oh, yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen it yet, definitely see it. And they in the movie they announced there's going to be a fourth one, because, I mean, it ends with a cliffhanger, and they're like, you know, tweet this for this character to survive, and tweet something else for this character to die, and we'll find out the results in Sharknado 4. We're not done yet.
That's awesome, though. I mean, that's engaging people. Why don't we do something like that? Hey, folks, tweet us if you want us to continue podcasting. Remain silent if you want us to die.
Oh, yeah. We may not get another episode if we do that. We better just continue on. And there's another one that came out this week, too, that I had forgot about being announced, called Lavalantula. It's about giant fire-breathing spiders attacking Hollywood.
I mean, because why not? I mean, that's definitely a thing.
Yeah, the movie is, the cool thing about the movie is it stars Steve Guttenberg from the Police Academy movies, and also has like cameos from, I can't remember his name, the one who does all the voice effect, sound effects, and then I think the one of the whatever hooks, the tiny black female cop is in, like, pretty much this is like the Police Academy reunion movie with giant fire-breathing spiders. And it is just, I mean, even Ralph Garman from freaking Hollywood Babylon and a couple other podcasts is in it. So it's,
I mean, that's just awesome.
As a pirate too. He's like I said, if that's another one, if you can't sleep at night and you're on sci-fi, yeah, check that one out. That one's just bizarre enough to be right up my alley.
And what about Three-Headed Shark Attack?
I didn't see all of it. I saw a little bit of it, and it was bad.
That's exactly what I expected. So, I don't know. I figured, well, I don't know. I'm not going to give any spoilers on that one yet. We'll do a longer segment on that at another time. Maybe we'll just do a horrible sci-fi segment at some point. Like,
I think next year we need to do our version of Shark Week during Shark Week, where we just talk about all the bad shark-related movies that's on sci-fi.
I mean, there's only about 30 mega shark movies.
Yeah. I think I watched all of them last week because, yeah, it was a slow week. So anything else in the news there, Brad?
I mean, that's all I can think of right now, running on limited sleep, limited brain cells.
Oh, if you happen to see a robot on the side of the road, Hitchbot is now touring the U.S. of A.
Oh, yeah. Where's he at now? Pittsburgh or somewhere?
Yeah,
or?
Philly was the last check-in I saw. Yeah, they did this experiment they're saying it's an experiment on trust. It started off in Canada where they have this robot it's immobile. I mean, it can't move on its own. And they basically dropped it off somewhere with a note saying, hey, I want to get to this other city and seeing if people will pick up this robot and take them across the country. It's got a camera in it where it can like post pictures of where it's at on Twitter. And it even has like an AI where it can have conversations with the people that offer him a ride. And last year it made it like from one coast to coast in Canada in like 26 days. So they're like, let's bring him to America and see how the Americans deal with him. He's been here like a week and he's only made it like two states. So he's not doing well. But so if you see him, give the dude a ride. I mean, I think we could just road trip up there and pick him up. You know, and since he can talk to us, we could do our first like actual robot interview for our science segment. I'm game. Let's.
So what can you tell us about this impending robot doom? I'm so paranoid about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that would be something interesting to put on the podcast. All right. With that, I guess we'll wrap this episode up. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Cigar Nerd Pod. Go to our website, cigarnerdpodcast.com. Follow us on the ESO network at esopodcast.com. Check out our Zazzle store at Zazzle/Cigar Nerd Podcast. And as always, if you're caught, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of your existence. This podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast with your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.